All right, cool. My name is Steve Forte. Oh, we have a slide for this. Why am I doing it in Excel? I'm making it harder. My name is Stephen Forte. I am an American, born and raised in New York City. However, I work for a European company. I mean, I actually physically work in Europe, but I live in Asia. It's a very confusing. I know, it's very confusing. It has to do with a girl. I'll just leave it at that. My wife happens to live in Asia, so it's there you go. I'm also a Microsoft regional director for the New York region, though I live in Hong Kong. So again, I don't have a region. I don't direct anything. I'm an MVP, certified Scrum Master. I'm a member of the board of directors of the Scrum Alliance. So I apparently know a thing or two about Scrum. And like Joel, I work at Telerik. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer.
Which means he takes a lot of vacation.
I don't know what that means, but I'll trust Joel on that one.
Follow him on Twitter. You'll see what I mean. It's
It's
crazy.
just because when I go to China for the weekend, it's like going from Orlando, it's like going from the Peabody Hotel to the convention center. So he thinks I'm going on vacation, I'm just buying milk. Okay, so what are we going to talk about today, Joel? First, we should probably just start off with a definition of what an estimate is. And if you've seen kind of Joel or I speak on estimation before, we've got about five slides. And then we're going to tell stories that will apply the mechanics, but we're going to set the stage with a few stories. And I like to start with the definition of estimation because it leads into the estimation problem. So we're going to talk about what estimation is. We're going to talk about the problem. We're going to look at kind of some historical trends, and then we're going to apply that to agile estimation. And the reason why we're going to do that is we want to kind of put the emphasis on that agile estimation has its roots in the past. So when you go back to your offices, you'll be able to say, you know, this has its roots in waterfall. You'll be able to sell agile estimation a little better. So Wikipedia, I lifted this off Wikipedia. It says, you know, an estimate or estimation is the calculated approximation of a result, which is usable, okay, even if the input data is incomplete or inaccurate.
Ooh, who provides an estimate in your job today with incomplete or inaccurate information? Raise your hand.
That should be 100%.
Excellent. So this is a correct statement then, I would say.
It is a correct statement. However, who gets pissed off when the weatherman like predicts a really bad hurricane the next day and you cancel a party outdoors and then it's a beautiful sunny day? Who gets really pissed off when that happens? Okay. It's not only about 50% of the room.
The rest are just like, it's okay.
It's whatever. We don't care about the weatherman. Those people are management. So here's the problem with estimation.
This is a picture of my bathroom.
That's a Canadian bathroom.
This is a Canadian bathroom.
That American wood, though? Oh, sorry.
No, your softwood comes from Canada, my friend.
Oh,
As well as your oil. How big is my house? No,
In square meters or
you
square feet?
Square feet, please, because this is all the information you should need, right? I mean, come on. Like, work it out.
He's got the him and her sink. I would kill for the him and her sink. My wife is programmed, genetically programmed, that when I brush my teeth, she could be over there on the phone with her mother to come away and push me out of the sink and say, I'm not brushing my teeth. Because of fights with her brother when she was a kid. So two sinks to me equals big.
So yell it out. What's the square footage of my house? Why
What?
Are you guessing? Why wouldn't you be asking me more questions?
Well, Joel, let's give them a little more information. So what were some
Well,
of the numbers?
no.
What were some of the numbers we heard?
I'm the
4,000?
typical customer. This is all I'm giving you, right? Now, I want you to commit to this, right?
Wait, so we had 4,000. What was the other one? 1,200. I'll give you some information. Joel lives in Winnipeg. Land is cheap. I live in Hong Kong, hence the Hong Kong rugby jersey. And I live in 650 square feet, and I have one sink. So that means, in my estimate, you have two sinks. You are definitely probably 1,300 or 1,300 square feet. So that's
Okay.
going to be my
All
guesstimate,
right.
since I have one sink in Hong Kong.
Anybody else? Ooh, that's a good question. I've got a
Ooh.
Three-car garage.
Hold on, other info.
That is the master bathroom attached to the bedroom. Sorry? How many bathrooms? I've got four bathrooms. How many bedrooms? Five bedrooms.
Whoa!
Sorry?
He makes me stay at a hotel when I come visit. Five bedrooms. Holy crappers.
Sorry?
How big is
my house?
Ah. We're not fooling. We're not falling for that one.
You almost tricked me there. How many floors? Two floors with a finished basement.
How many square feet per floor?
Depends if you count the open area or not.
You're not going to answer that question?
Well, here's an interesting question. So yell out more estimates. I'd like to hear them. 3,700 square feet. 7,000 square feet. How much did I pay for the house?
It's Canadian dollars.
I'll give you an estimate. More than $100. It's 100% correct.
That estimate's 100% 100% of the time.
So here's what I find very interesting, and this happens over and over again. Every time we kind of do this exercise and I ask people to give me an estimate, you're giving me a single number.
What about a range?
What about a range? Why wouldn't you say, Joel, it's from 1,000 feet square feet to 5,000 square feet? Because guess what? You'd be 100% accurate, probably, wouldn't you? But you're calling out real specific numbers, right? And I think one of the points that we're trying to get to is that we're giving you a small amount of information. And right away, we felt that we had to answer what the estimate was based on just what I gave you, right?
It's
because that's what our lives are. Like, okay, I've got this feature. How much is that going to cost? 2 weeks, right? But in reality, we might want to approach this a little differently. See what happened when we started to have a conversation, right? What happened?
More information came out.
We started learning more. We had more information. But it was still very interesting to me that we were still offering up a single number for your estimate versus a range of numbers, which would probably capture the estimate a lot more accurately.
So does anyone want to take one more guess before Joel guess? I used the correct term. Before Joel gives us the number?
There you go. See, now
someone said 2,000, but someone said another one over there.
You are correct.
0 to 10,000 is cheating, but I'll still write it down.
You are 100% correct.
Let me ask the audience a question here, and this actually will demonstrate the what we're trying to do with agile estimation. Is how many people think that your initial thought, your initial guess, was correct? Okay, two or three, four people. How many people think after you got all the other information about the three-car garage, the obnoxious amounts of bedrooms, again, I stay in the hotel, like this crappy little flea bag hotel without heat in the winter in Winnipeg.
It's called an igloo.
How many people think that after you had that conversation and you got that information that the estimate would have gotten better, that your second attempt, your third attempt, your fourth attempt would get better? Okay. Great. Almost, I would say, 85% of the room said that. Joel, what is the answer?
2,900 square foot, not counting the basement. Or the garage.
Or the garage. Okay. So getting that 2,900 square foot from this picture is quite difficult.
But is that what we have to deal with when we build software? Right, it's kind of like that. We're given these hints. It's kind of like you want to build a house, and so your house contractor, which would be you, would come and meet with the customers like, okay, so tell me about the house you want to build. Well, I want blue walls, and
I want
tile.
Two sinks.
How much? Right? We're asked to do this a lot, aren't we? And then what's even better is that we're asked to commit to it. We can't be wrong, because that'd be bad. We can't be very good at our jobs if we can't even estimate correctly, right? So this is kind of why we're talking about this session. This is a pain that has haunted us
as an industry
and us personally for many, many years. I come from a consulting background where our estimates became our commitments, right? Isn't that kind of interesting? Where our estimates, which are a guess based on incomplete information, becomes our commitment that we have to hold against. So what did we end up doing?
Padding.
Right.
Lying.
You've done this before, man. She's had two correct answers already.
Yeah.
If Joel starts spacing out, I'll have you come up and do it with me.
Yeah, that's okay.
So let me ask everyone this question, and we'll stop asking questions a lot, but we still will ask questions. How many people have been in this scenario? And you have woken up in the morning, and you was like, today we're delivering the software. The website is going live. And long story short, it did not go live that day. How many people have had that situation? Okay, holy crap, everybody. So your estimates are pretty lousy, even on the same day, right? How can you be expected to deliver an accurate estimate when all you know is the bathroom, right? In the software project, analogy to the bathroom would be the initial concept phase, and then commit on that and execute on that. So there has actually been a lot of academic research, and we're going to bore you for 2 or 3 minutes with academic research, but it is actually of the most critical importance, and I apologize because the tech ed people reformatted the slide, but I think you can see it. This is called the cone of uncertainty. I'll let the animation complete. Can everyone more or less see the cone? Okay, I know it's white on blue. It's a little different. What this says is the following. At the beginning of the project, at the very, very beginning, the initial concept, when you see just the bathroom, your initial estimates are off by a factor of 4, which means if you estimate that the house was 1,000 square feet, it could have been as small as 250 square feet, or as large as 4,000 square feet. Or if it was a software project, if you estimated 1 year at the initial concept stage, statistics will tell us, the academic research tells us, that statistically speaking, you're off by a factor of 4, and if you estimated 1 year, it could take as long as 4 years or as short as 3 months. Almost never happens in that direction, right? If it does, I'm giving you my resume. Or you could just come to work at Telerik.
Well, and the other thing that we have to realize, and this is very interesting, is that building software is not a technology problem. Building software is a human problem, because what we're trying to do is figure out how humans work and solve some of those problems. So for example, there's two things that I like to talk about. One is called the student syndrome. Raise your hand if you were a student.
At one point in your life?
Who didn't raise their hand?
Kate Gregory with the PhD.
She was born with a PhD. She was, actually.
She was.
So the student syndrome is kind of like this, and I was the worst. So if you were given an assignment that was due in 3 months, you would run back to your dorm, start working on it until you got it done, right? Or you would what? Wait until the last possible moment in time that you can get it done, then cram. There's another interesting human element. It's called Parkinson's Law. And Parkinson's Law is kind of simple, and maybe oversimplified, is that air fills the container, right? So that if I have an estimate of 2 weeks, it will likely take me 2 weeks plus a little bit to do it.
Meaning if my boss gives me the job of drinking this bottle of water in 2 weeks, I will find a way to make that take 2 weeks. I will not come in over.
So
under.
We struggle with a lot of these human problems when it comes to not only estimation, but also in the aspect of delivery as well. And these make, it really difficult to reconcile actual versus our estimates and try to figure out how we can become better at estimation.
So let's take a look at the human problem that Joel was just talking about, both Parkinson's Law and student syndrome. And as I said, we're going to bore you a little bit with the theory and the academic part, because the cone of uncertainty is born from that. Because of the student syndrome, because of Parkinson's Law, because we're just not good at estimating, that's okay, right? That as your project progresses, your estimate gets better. We all know this, right? The estimates of Joel's house got better as we gave you more information. So what the cone of uncertainty does is, if you see on the bottom, is kind of the traditional phases in a waterfall cycle. But you can, well, we'll get to that in a minute about Agile. But if you look at product approved, requirements done, now our level of inaccuracy is by a factor of maybe 2, which means that initial 1 year estimate could be as bad as 2 years or as good as 6 months.
Now, why do you think that is? I think simply put, we can say we know more.
Exactly.
At the very beginning, we know less. At the very end, we know more. If we know more, then we're able to make better decisions. And in fact, someone mentioned the whole Kanban thing in the past, and this is why we like to talk a little bit about lean in our lectures, is that lean,
we're trying to get lean
in the whole, yeah, me too, in the manufacturing world, focuses on knowledge and the gathering of knowledge so we can make really good, well-informed decisions. And when we talk about agile estimation, this is kind of the premise that we want to talk about as well, is what can we do to gain more knowledge that essentially takes our uncertainty away from our estimates, hence the cone of uncertainty.
So what we'll do is I'm going to ask a question, and the question is as follows. How many people think that their managers, their users, understand and know about the cone of uncertainty? Only about 6 people in the room. Was that six or three?
It was four.
I beg to differ. I think every single manager, every single person who's ever worked on a software project knows the cone of uncertainty exists. They just don't know the fancy academic name for it.
And you can go back and tell them now.
So the reason is the cone of uncertainty has its roots in waterfall, where all the research is done. However, the cone of uncertainty directly applies to today's day and age when you're in an agile environment. So what we want to do now is pivot over and talk about agile estimation. We're going to define it, and then we'll tell you the mechanics of how to do it. But agile estimation says the following. Instead of fighting the cone of uncertainty, embrace it. Instead of pretending the cone of uncertainty doesn't exist, use it to your advantage. And what agile estimation says is at the end of every iteration, or at the end of every sprint, if you're using Scrum, since most of you are, perform a re-estimation of the project. Reprioritize the backlog, and allow the project to then be reprioritized and re-estimated. So once again, what agile estimation is, very, very simple, is re-estimating the project at the end of every iteration. So instead of traditional phases here, you would just put them with sprint one, sprint two, sprint three, sprint four, sprint five, sprint six, knowing that in sprint one, that your estimates are going to be pretty bad. But knowing afterwards, it takes about four or five sprints, that's been my experience, that your estimates start to smooth out, and you can start giving it a level of confidence.
Here's something else that's kind of interesting, though. A prioritization is a function of your estimates, aren't they? So if I say, hey, Steve,
yes,
you know, go Joel, get me a coffee. How much money should I give you?
Give me between $1 and $1 million.
Right. If the coffee is $1 million, do I want the coffee? No.
Probably not.
But if it's a buck, I want the coffee, right? So your prioritization will always be a function of the cost of the widget that you need. It will always be a function of it. So this is why your estimates and your sizes and your assumptions are very, very important to everything you do.
And just one quick sidebar, just a little off track for 1 second, is some of you are probably sitting there saying, this is great, I kind of get it, but you know, I work at an ISV, or I work as a consultant, or I work in government. So I'm not sure this is gonna work. They're not gonna let me with a fixed bid project re-estimate. We're not going to tell you how to do that right there, but at the end, we will circle back to those scenarios real briefly to give you some kind of advice and feedback. We are more of a theory course, but we would like to get a little deeper in those details because the two of us have a tremendous amount of experience with those three scenarios in the consulting environment, in the, everyone here has unlimited time and unlimited budget, right?
Everyone, raise your hand if you have unlimited.
I'm looking for the one guy to raise his hand because I'm going to give him my resume.
Yeah, me too.
Darn. Okay. So once again, agile estimation, we talked a lot about the past. We talked about the cone of uncertainty, which basically says is the more you know, the better you estimate, right? And that's the easy way to say it. You know, the cone of uncertainty is the fancy way. So agile estimation actually takes the cone of uncertainty, uses it to your advantage, reprioritizes, re-estimates the project after every sprint.
Now, what isn't agile estimation or estimation? What if I said to you, sir, what's your name? Kark. You have 2 weeks to deliver this feature. Give me an estimate.
I'll give you a hint.
Right? Does that happen? That's real world, right? By the way, that's not estimation. That's called solving a problem within the constraints. By the way, that's okay. In fact, that allows us to be pretty creative and focus really on value. In fact, we like constraints. It's very, very difficult to have pure estimates without any constraints, right? So if I just want to tell my developers, just go ahead and estimate the backlog. You know, they're probably all going to be pretty darn big estimates. And I'll go back and say, that estimate's too big. You'll need to get that done sooner than later. And they go, maybe we can do that because we can change our approach to implementation. Maybe instead of giving you an Uber feature, we're going to give you a small feature, right? And this is also part of the conversation that you need to have around Agile, is understanding the concept of size and scope and whether or not you're truly providing an estimate or if, in fact, you're solving a problem, which is changing your implementation or changing your approach based on a particular constraint that you have to work with.
So
you should embrace that.
So what Joel just described to you, you might be thinking, hey, that's great. Why am I sitting here then? Because I'm always given, you know, do this in 2 weeks or do this in 4 months. You might work at a bank where you have a government regulation where you face $1 million a day fine if you don't have certain things done by a certain day. You can still use the mechanics of agile estimation that we're going to show you. I might as well pull that slide up. you can still use the mechanics of agile estimation and figure out how that all works. You'll just say the certain features are going to be different, but the time is fixed. Okay? So you're able to use these techniques. So how do we actually perform? What are the mechanics of agile estimation? It's very, very straightforward. It's very simple. You start with a user story, and Joel's going to kind of walk us through what a user story is, for those of you that don't know what it is. And then we'll talk about story points and planning poker and how those relate. And we have some good stories behind a lot of that. And then we'll talk very briefly about the product backlog, which you probably already all know a little bit about or a lot about. And then the concept of velocity. And then we'll talk lastly about, you know, doing the actual re-estimation. Then we'll pop into Excel and start to get into a little bit of mechanics. So that's what we'll do for the next, I guess, about an hour to go.
I don't know.
So Joel, why don't you tell us about a user story?
Well, you know, a user story is not something that's completely new to the Agile world. It's just a different way of trying to represent value. And what it does is it embraces who you're presenting value to and the benefits that they get from what you're giving them. But it also gives a little bit more than just, you know, implement OK button on screen. It talks about so that they can do something, so that they can achieve some goal, right? And it also allows us to express this in a way that is kind of void of implementation, that allows us to focus on what we're trying to achieve versus how we're trying to implement that. And this is quite liberating. And the other thing that it provides us is the ability for us to really understand value and focus on value and not just the feature. Because really what we're trying to truly do in the Agile world is to think about providing the most amount of value to the customer in the shortest amount of time and keep on evolving that as our understanding of value also evolves. User stories also give us an opportunity to think about a flow of features, if you will. A user story might actually be a number of different screens implemented in a different way, and it incorporates and allows us to make sure that our application actually fulfills or allows the user to achieve those goals. Are they agile? Well, we kind of did that kind of stuff before we called it agile. Maybe we went overboard and, you know, we're using UML to describe everything, but our goal there was very much the same. We're trying to think about the person involved, the persona, the actor, if you will, from the UML, and thinking about the value that they want to achieve from using the system and making sure that we're never giving them partial value, we give them end-to-end value. So we like user stories in the Agile world because it gives us that laser-like focus on value and allows us to speak in the same language as our users do, which is really kind of key to the whole Agile world.
So just to get to the mechanics, so Joel gave you the theory behind it and why we do it, and you know, Joel is very big on, you know, when computer systems should work the way humans work, right? Because if not, we're going to be fighting with those systems. And user stories really personify that. And the mechanics of a user story, if you're coming to agile estimation for the very first time, is pretty straightforward. It says, as a role, as Joel said, you know, you can use a persona. And the role could be what, Joel? Like a customer service representative.
Sure.
So as a customer service representative, I would like to perform an action, some type of function. So I would like to be able to search for customers by first and last name, okay, in order to, and then the goal would be to provide customer service, you know, when the customer's on the phone. That provides not just the business value, but the context of the user story itself. User stories also have the acceptance criteria. And the user stories are written by the user, so the acceptance criteria is not always written quite perfectly, but it's a good attempt for then the team to see what is it that they want to see, and the testers, we asked, there was a couple testers in the room, could start thinking of a test case when they read the user story.
What's really great about the acceptance criteria, which is something, a new focus that we really look at in user stories today, is that they define what done looks like, right? Have you ever heard that? So how are you doing on this feature? It's like, I'm 82% done. What does that mean? There's no 82% done in a user story. It's either all done or not done. It's either 0 or 100%, right? So when we think about defining done, that's what we want. We want a target. We want to understand what value looks like. And what's really cool is that if we take it from this perspective, now we can test to get it against it. Has anybody heard of things like test-driven development, right? Behavioral-driven development? You can now start taking these definitions.
Yes. Yeah, all fads.
You can take these definitions of user stories and start immediately wrapping tests around it because you know what done looks like. So they play a really big role when it comes to estimation. Now, that being said, You don't have to have user stories to do agile estimation. It's just something that we recommend because it is a good practice to understand what value is. But if you truly need to estimate widgets or something that's not a user story, that's perfectly acceptable.
You could call them units of work, whether
feature points, whatever.
So we have a tendency as humans to try to estimate, but we're really good at comparing things. So Joel, why don't you talk about story points and how humans can compare things and what story points are?
So humans, again, remember I said this is a human problem. So let's think about how humans work. Let me ask you.
He's big on that.
Which holds more water? Can anybody tell me?
The blue pill.
Blue one. What color? No.
Are you sure?
Are you sure? Are you pretty sure about that? How much more water? Twice?
Twice? Let's test that theory. we only have an hour.
Did you see that? That's pretty accurate.
That's more accurate than the estimate you did on Joel's house.
Right.
Right?
We're actually really good at comparing two things and saying if one is bigger than the other and by how many times. Weird. In fact, we can do that even in software. We can look at a feature and go, is this feature bigger than this one? Yep. How much more? About twice? We're pretty good at that. So why don't we actually leverage that? Why don't we estimate by comparing things? By assigning an abstract number to this. Let's call this thing a 3.
How about a 1?
Oh, no, a 3. Because I could have something smaller than this.
True.
Right? So let's call it a 3. What would this be? A 6. 5.
He's being contrarian.
Well,
I like that about you.
Fibonacci sequence.
I like
crazy
that about
stuff
him.
Like
we
that.
Don't care about Fibonacci.
Right. So that
mathematicians need not apply.
That actually comes down to, so what numbering mechanism do we start off with? How did I assign this to a 3? Turns out.
He made it up.
Doesn't matter. As long as you always call that a 3. Right? Or something about this size should always be about a 3. Doesn't matter. Because you're just using a mathematical way of measuring two things. So why did he say 5? Well, because some teams like to choose a pre-canned sequence, powers of 2, Fibonacci sequences, something that they can, some scale that they can go towards. Some teams actually have 1, 3, 5, too big. I'm not kidding you. And that works really well as well. So if you're trying to estimate this, teams can say, I can't get that done in a sprint. Or I don't have a clue, right? So that makes that estimation possible. Yeah?
How do you turn a unit to natural
number of hours? You need to do some calibration. We're going to actually talk about calibration and how that works. But this does kind of happen because a lot of people say, well, how much is this going to cost? Right? It's a 5.
Well, let me go a little... And let me go a little further with that. Joel first said that this was a 3, and then we estimated as a group that this was a 6. So what if Joel said, this is a 10? And then you guys all say, this is a 20. All right, so that means at the end of the day, if we choose a baseline, the coffee cup, and estimate 10 user stories against that baseline, and our initial starting point, I usually like to start with 1, okay? Because I like to start with the basic one, and then sometimes we get halves and a quarters. Joel likes to start with 3. You might start with a 10. Which team is doing better? You have 400 story points in your queue, and we have 20 story points in the queue. It could be the exact same project, two different teams working the exact same thing. You just start with different relative baselines.
Right. And then you start calibrating over time, which is really quite critical to the way Agile works is the calibration. So let's maybe answer that question.
Well,
how would I calibrate this? Well, here's the thing. In Agile, we would guess if I could tell you how long it would actually take for us to do 10, you know, 5 story points. But what we can do is actually do it and then measure it, right? And then I can tell you. And this is why in methodologies that are iterative, like Scrum, for example, you might take a sprint and actually just work. Try to get as much done as you can. And you come out at the end of the sprint, it's like, my team did 20 story points. Okay. So if my team is 5 people and they all work, and the sprint was 1 week long, and they work 40 hours a week, you start seeing how we can make the correlation between story points and hours. And by the way, those things are going to fluctuate over time. And this happens quite a bit. For example, my team was asked to do some custom features for a product that we're working on, and that's exactly how we came up with a cost estimate for being able to do this.
Hello? We're talking about team velocity before we get there.
Well, no, I'm not talking about velocity quite yet. I was talking about calibration.
Okay. So, bringing Joel back to the sequence, you know, you can kind of tell our philosophy of speaking. Joel goes the theory, I'm doing the hard mathematics and the application, right?
I'm being agile.
I'm the one making slides on the fly. I think I'm more agile.
Who's out of sequence here?
I put a smiley face on the out of sequence. I hope you like our making the slides on the fly. It's part of our shtick. Usually I start, when Joel talks too long, I start like making fun of him in the slides, so pay attention to what I write. So just to kind of wrap up story points and move on, because we have to then talk about the next two or three items so you kind of walk away with all the knowledge, is story points are a relative measurement against a baseline. So it doesn't matter what the baseline is. And you don't even need to call them points, because that gentleman in the back asked about hours. I'm glad he asked that, because I don't like to just call them story points. I was working at a company, it was about 12, 13 years ago, and I got the greatest piece of advice from a mentor. And he said, you need to, this was before Agile even really kind of, you know, was big and mainstream. He said, you need to estimate, no, not estimate, he goes, you need to kind of, you know, estimate all your stuff, pick a unit of measurement. I don't care if it's consistent, as long as you're consistently inconsistent, which I know sounds funny. And he goes, and give it a name. And he goes, name it after the CEO. So I worked at a company, and we named our unit of measurement. Her name was Amy McIntosh. This was before Apple's rebirth. And so we called them Macintoshes. How could she argue with the Macintoshes? She asked, how do I equate the Macintoshes to ours? But what we did is we printed out little Macintoshes that looked like bar coasters, and then said, well, this project has 40 Macintoshes. We'll let you guys choose the features you want to go on. Right? And this was before agile estimation. After we delivered a chunk of work, we said, well, now we have 30 Macintoshes left, and then kind of redistributed those Macintoshes. So that's the point. Story points don't really mean anything except that they are a measurement or an estimate against a baseline. And what you do is you give each of your user stories or your units of work a story point estimate. So your question probably is, how do you do that? Right? So before we drill into the details, anyone here want to work on a project with me? Who thinks it would be cool to work on a project with me?
It's so not cool.
Yeah, it really isn't. Okay, so there's a lot of smart people in this room. Let me say this a different way. They teach you in speaker school, if you don't get the answer you want, ask the question differently. How many people think that I might have, I've been told this maybe by my wife, an overpowering personality, I may cut you off while we're having a conversation, interrupt a lot. Who thinks I might do that?
Oh,
all
yeah,
of you
there.
Should be raising your hand.
Everyone, that should be 100% participation. So let's go through a typical scenario. We are estimating, Joel, make up a feature.
We are going to create a customer logon screen for our new web-based version of
blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah.
And this fine young lady here, who has been so helpful, in her head, she's like, that's going to take like a week. That's really, we've got the database that has to connect to the stored procedures, and this is 2012, we use ORMs. Okay, so we got the entity framework, but I have to learn the entity framework, and we have this, we have that, we have Azure, we have this, it's gonna take a week. And I, before she says 1 week, I go, only an idiot would do this in less than an hour. I mean, this is the easiest feature of all time. And I happen to be your boss. What's your new estimate? Would you still say 1 week? How many people would still say 1 week? You guys can all work on projects with me then. But 50% of the room did not. Okay? So how do we mitigate this? Joel, that's a cue for you to talk.
What did we do right at the very beginning of the session when we were trying to guess the square footage of my house? What do we have? We have this thing called a
conversation.
It's crazy.
It's weird. It's totally agile.
Right? But what we were trying to learn in that conversation is, we just wanted to gather more knowledge. So if we had more knowledge, we had the ability to have more confidence in our estimate, which essentially narrows down our range, the estimates that we provide. So one of the things that we want to do in Agile, remember that this is a human thing, and Agile promotes human-type stuff. You know,
he's big on this touchy-feely
stuff.
He's
real big on this. You know, we'd like to communicate the way humans communicate. And one of the things that we'd like to do is have this discussion. So there is this model called planning poker that is a facilitation of this discussion. Should we go through a little bit of a demonstration?
Yes, we should.
We don't have planning poker cards.
We do not have planning poker cards.
Let's just use these.
Okay.
Just pretend.
I'm going to pretend. So here you go. This is your planning poker card. Okay, give me my planning poker card. So, scenario
A. Can I have one?
You can have one too, Joel. Actually, the whole team plays planning poker. Designers, testers, so you would have two cards.
Oh, come here.
Give him one. So, we wanted to estimate, well, I inappropriately, to make the story more fun and powerful, I used the word weeks. And she was saying 1 week, I was saying 1 hour. But you estimate in story points. And you're estimating against the baseline. So what's our baseline? This.
Three.
So the way that we do is, let's just say we have we don't really have, hold on a second. I'll just say Big Beer Stein.
Ooh, Oktoberfest.
That's what I was thinking. I was just talking about Oktoberfest today. Where's one of the... Yeah, this one. Okay, so we're going to estimate this compared to our baseline. Okay? In the previous example, I was just being the domineering SOB saying, no, it is the same as the coffee cup. No, it is the same as the coffee cup, and probably beat you into submission. And if I'm the boss, I would probably win. So let's do planning poker. Joel, you're going to be the facilitator.
All right. So we're going to have a conversation about this feature. And we all have an opportunity to ask a bunch of questions. We'll pretend we did that, okay?
And how much beer is in that mug, Joel?
Yes. At the end of
can I drink that beer?
At the end of this conversation, we're going to raise our estimates at the same time, and provide that estimate. So we're ready. One, too late. Oops. Too early. Ready. One, two, three. We hold up the estimates. Mine says 9. What does yours say?
Mine says 3.
Okay. What does yours say? 7. What does yours say? 6. So why did we have different estimates?
And he's got a cup on his iPhone.
Coffee cup.
Can't fit it.
So essentially now we have differences of opinion. So what do we do next? No. We have a discussion.
It's all about the conversation. Remember, he's the touchy-feely guy.
Why? So tell me about your mother, right?
Well, Joel, having met my mother.
This is the heart of agile estimation, is this conversation. Why do you say 6? Why do you say 7? Why did you say 3? Steve, yours is way out there. Why did you say 3? Is it as big as this? Really?
I'm gonna be honest with you. I really thought I was saying 9. I wanted to say it was 3 times as large, so I didn't understand the rules.
Oh, okay. So now we've clarified that.
So does that mean? That means we can vote again?
That means you didn't listen the first time.
Correct, but does that mean I can just say it's a 9? As opposed to fighting saying it was a 3?
Actually, what we're trying to do is have consensus, right? And what's really great about this is that it allows our team...
I estimate that guy's got a bump on his butt.
It allows our team to have a conversation. So you know why in Agile we want to have the user involved all the time? I mean, where do we want them involved? With just our project manager and business analyst, right? No, we want them connected with the team so we can have these human-based discussions. And what this does is it allows us to flow that information around so that everybody on the team has a good understanding of what that feature is outside of having to read specifications, right? Who here loves to read specifications and goes to specifications only to tell them what to develop? Right?
Anyone? No takers?
I'm not saying documentation is bad. I'm just saying that collaboration
is good.
Better. Right? We might want to write things down once we've decided what we're building. That's okay. But to use it as a communication vehicle is really important. What this also does is it takes away the dominant person in the group. So I once worked with an organization that had the project manager do all estimates.
That works. How did that work out on that project?
Yeah, we're right on budget all the time. It seems absurd, but the reality is this happens a lot. So what we're doing right now is we're talking with testers and we're talking with developers and the customer could be there to help clarify some of our discussion points, to have that conversation so we can learn more, so we can understand more of what we're doing. And by the way, will we be 100%
we have a question.
Correct? Oh, sorry.
Thank you for making him stop talking. Repeat the question, because that is the number one question
we get. The question was, what do you estimate, right?
And when you're playing planning poker.
When you're playing planning poker. And I'll have to tell you that I've gone through a number of different flavors from this, and I found that all of them kind of work depending on the team. Some teams just say, when will this get to done? Done being tested, out the door, part of the build, shipped. Others might have no control on your testing cycles. You might still work for an organization that has a QA process or an integration process that you have absolutely no control over. So I'd say estimate up to your boundaries and then
that just doesn't bode well. Like the Martian, like
I don't know.
The Klingons are coming or something. So Joel brings up a point, is that in the kind of rules or the philosophy of Agile, you're all being cross-functional, you have one big team. So if you are in that environment, you estimate the entirety of the piece of work. Right? You're estimating a user story, right? And what Joel is saying is that's not always the case. So if your organization works where you sequence things down, or in a Kanban environment where you're doing things, estimate the sequence of work that you will be doing.
But you have control over.
Yeah. The other important thing is that everyone who's doing the work participates in the estimate.
For example, the testers could be, well, that might be easy to implement, but really hard to test, right? So then we have that discussion. Well, since it's really hard to test, maybe the number goes up. Yeah, you're right, that's going to be really hard to test. How are we going to do load testing on that when we don't have a load testing system, right? So now the estimate becomes larger because of the effort to test.
We have a question over there, Joel.
Planning poker.
Well, okay, you just... For those who didn't hear him, he said, planning poker doesn't seem to work when you have one person doing the work. And I would agree with you.
Yeah.
I mean, you can play it by yourself, but it's really a few times. Well, you know what you could do is you could get hats. You could put the tester hat on, you know, and then you get fights with yourself.
The only way that it would help in
no,
this...
No, I swear, this is hard to test.
No, the only reason that would very, really good to do planning poker is to have those conversations so that you as a developer know what the scope is. Because during the planning poker, you have a lot of conversations about what we are developing and what you're not developing, and that adds clarity to what you're estimating.
And if you're on a team of one, which I assume you are, you would have asked the question, you obviously are delivering the software for somebody else, and you may want to take some of the principles and values of planning poker and the other things we've spoken about, and maybe do it with the people you're delivering it with. So at least you're having the conversation with them. And they might say, you probably don't want to go through the whole process if you're doing all the work by yourself of saying, this is a 5, this is a 3, and arguing with the business person that doesn't understand the concept of, like, you know, an ODBC driver. But you want to probably take some of the values of the facilitating the conversation.
Two more.
Oh, wait, hold on. We have three, we'll take three more questions and move to the next spot. We have two here and one there.
Yeah. One of the challenges that I encountered was the business wants to define a release date, that, you know, I want this product to be released on whatever date it is. And they could be undergoing this scrum and reevaluating it. The features change also, that this feature will be part of the release, this might not be part of the release. Like, what is the best approach here? Like, you know, giving it, because everybody wants a date.
We love this question.
Repeat
the question and paraphrase.
The question is what do you do when you have a fixed date, right? That's kind of the paraphrasing you. Guess what? Prioritize the backlog. Well, we live in this world.
Telerik has 3 releases a year of our main tool. We released today. So I can tell you the release dates. It's February, June, and October. And I can tell you the exact days. I can even tell you the time. Okay? I can't tell you all the features that are in there.
So this comes to the triangle, right? We have always three sides of the triangle.
We always talk about the triangle.
He always brings up this triangle.
Where you have cost.
What about pet insurance?
I'm not talking about pet insurance today. Where you have cost. What else do you have? Time and scope. You can only control 2. What's that? Good, fast, cheap. Well, what's really great about
like
this
that.
Constraint?
You've done this before.
What's really great about
I'm
this constraint is that it allows you to focus like a laser on value and maybe have discussions about changing the implementation. And this is what we do all the time. As a product owner, as a division manager, I want certain things to be in a release. And my team goes, well, we can't fit in all of your must-haves. Okay, so now we're having a conversation. So could you scale this must-have down to this? And they're like, yeah, we can scale this down. So we're now having those conversations of scope and value. And that allows us to change our way of approaching our implementation and thus our estimates around that. So that collaboration, that discussion, is facilitated by two sides of the triangle. Now we're in danger if I'm trying to fix all 3.
And I just want to make a point. So we brought up a scenario. There's 2 scenarios we've talked about so far. Unlimited time and unlimited budget. Agile estimation works great.
Perfectly.
Actually, any form of estimation works great. Actually, if you have unlimited time and unlimited budget, you should just be coding and not even estimating. However, the next scenario we just described is we have fixed deadline, fixed cost, but we have some flexibility with the features. It may be to get there, right? You might have to have a little bit of arguments, and I prefer to use the term, you know, conversations. But you may have to negotiate with the business, but you have flexibility in the features. Our business, Telerik, is a great example of that. Our CEO doesn't think we have flexibility with the features on the release dates, but we do. And ultimately, yeah, don't tell him. This isn't being recorded, is it? I hope not. He's asleep anyway. They're 7 or 8 time zones ahead. So the third scenario is fixed deadline, fixed features, fixed budget. And that's usually when you're in a regulatory environment or some kind of emergency environment, like Apollo 13? Yes, Apollo 13. Get the guys down from the moon.
They were agile.
They were very agile. Or if you were in the European Union and they just decided, oh, we're changing the rules on how banks structure debt because we just bailed out, like, I don't know, they're
that,
up to like
that
the 15th.
That would never happen.
They're up to like the 15th country.
Never happen.
Yeah, last week I was speaking at a BizSpark conference in Europe, and it was they said, hashtag BizSparkEU, and then the facilitator said, well, it's BizSparkEU minus Greece and Spain is the,
Well, what's kind of interesting about this conversation is that in order to have your customer be variable on one of those edges, right, maybe the scope side, because, and we chose scope a lot because it's one thing that we probably are guessing at to begin with, right? We're guessing at feature sizes, we're guessing at what even features we need. But we can be very specific about cost and timeline. But what you actually need to there is having a trust relationship. And a lot of people say, well, how do you do this in a consulting environment? Well, guess what? It's tough. It's really tough until you have a trust relationship with the customer. But I tell you, it's possible.
Once you build it.
We actually worked with an organization, a very big financial organization. When we started, we didn't have any trust, right? So what did they want to do then? They wanted us to commit to all sides of the triangle. And even though they hired us because we're agile, go figure. So there was no trust. And guess what happens when you have no trust? Called a change request, right? It's called negotiation. It's called building that trust. So it says, we're actually trying to deliver you the most value in your constraints. And now that we've learned more, we have to adapt to that learning. To the point where I would be heading off to the lake with my family. I get a call from the project manager. This is a simulated conversation. She'd call me up and say, hey, Joel, I've got like $100,000 to spend. What can we build it on? You know why? Because the project manager was hitting her budget and timeline every time. She's looking great. Her project scorecard was awesome, right?
Do the math.
100% of the time.
How much is a six-pack of beer?
In Canada or in the U.S.?
It's the same thing.
We're no, actually, in Canada is like $60.
Oh. Are you done?
Yeah,
on your tangent?
I'm done.
Cool. I just try to bring Joel back. It's what I do. And just to conclude that last part, and I know there was 2 questions, but we should probably move to the next item, is I never concluded on we had talked about unlimited time or unlimited budget, which really doesn't exist, but it does with R&D and some other things. Agile estimation works just fine. It gives you a great guidance of when the project will be done. You know, after a few iterations, you'll understand how much you're going to be spending. Then we have the fixed date, flexible features. Agile estimation will not predict the date, but by looking at how many sprints you are for completion, you then start removing items from the backlog to get to your date. So you can start predicting what features will be in. It still follows the cone of uncertainty. The last scenario where you have fixed deadline, fixed cost, and fixed features usually exists, as I said, when you're in some type of emergency situation or some type of regulatory situation. You can use the agile estimation techniques to have the conversation about more resources, or we're going to miss the deadline, and we're going to miss it by our estimate, say, 10 days. What's the fine? And you can start planning for that up front, right? So it's not going to solve those problems, but it's going to
expose them
much faster. So let's review, because we did get a tiny bit off track, but we are being agile. So we talked about user stories. We're estimating those stories in points. The facilitation process is called planning poker. It's optional. It's optional way of doing it, but as long as you have the trust, then you can have a conversation. We find it extremely effective. You can also do it online if your team is remote. You can do it over Skype with video chat, or you can actually go to planningpoker.com, which is a website that allows you to do planning poker for free, and you just register your email address and your name, and allows you to do planning poker for free online, where you can do the exact same process where it goes on and on. I still recommend that you have Skype going when you do that, just so the conversation is much easier as opposed to chat, but it makes sense. So let's just go, we have 1 or 2 more things about the mechanics. We're gonna skip talking about the product backlog because there's nothing to say about the product backlog. Now we have our user stories, we've estimated them in story points. Now we put all of our items in the product backlog. Does everyone understand what we've done so far? I mean, at least the product backlog. It's just a list of all the work to do. Okay, so consider a project back a product backlog to look something like this. You know, item one, you know, it's 33 points and it's high priority. Right? Item two. Oh, you think the queen is hot? She never was ever hot.
Totally hot.
Right? And this is a low priority. You get the point. Item three, it's at 18 and it's medium. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's the product backlog. So now we're ready to put this into action. We've actually done our first estimate. If we took the entire product backlog, and let's just say the sum of the entire product backlog equals, you know, 400 story points. Like if we just had a total, like, you know, this is dot, 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 so to speak. Or that's not a dot, dot, dot. Dot, dot, dot. And then we had a total, and the total was 400 story points. How long is that going to take to do?
2 weeks.
Right. We don't know yet. We have no idea. All we can say is this goes back to the gentleman's question, how do you equate this to hours? Now you go back to your baseline and you say, well, this team can do a, you know, user login page, if that was your baseline, in about 2 hours. Then you can say, well, this was, you know, maybe it's an 800-hour project. Right? That's one of the ways that you can do it. I tend to look at the baseline maybe as something that would take 1 day. It's still not ready to commit because we're at the code of uncertainty. We're still better. We're not at plus or minus 4. We've learned a lot about the project, but we're still probably off by a factor of 2, right? Because we haven't started coding yet. We haven't started, you know, we don't know what the surface area of the entire project is. So what do? You do the first sprint. Now there's two kind of, I won't call them rules, but strong suggestions. The first one is that your sprints are always of the same length or duration. So we like to do 2-week sprints. Mostly because at this point where my backlog says 400, I don't know what that is in time yet. I can guess, as I said, I could kind of say my baseline, right? My baseline was 1 day, this is 400 days, whatever it is, okay? So then you do your first sprint. The developers, is this familiar to everyone, right? Meaning is we have about a product backlog, developers commit to, let's say they're gonna commit to, I don't know, out of the 400, they're gonna commit to 40 items out of the backlog. How many do they complete? 5?
12?
12? Good guesses, because developers on a team that are new with each other and doing a new technology will always overcommit and underdeliver on the first 1 or 2 sprints. To teams that have been together a long time, working on familiar technology and familiar business domains, tend to get it about right on maybe the first sprint, but definitely by the second sprint. So let's just say they committed to 30. They completed 30 items. That leaves us with, we've done 30. So does that mean our product backlog now is 370? Right? Yes? No? Who thinks it's 370?
Bueller.
No, one guy. Who thinks it's more like 450? Yeah, exactly. Because now after your first iteration, the business has added a whole bunch of OBTWs. We all know what that is, right? Oh, by the way, exactly. The most painful words a software developer will ever hear. I have heard a lot of bad things like, honey, I want a divorce. I tell you, oh, by the way, is the worst thing, the worst 4 words in the English language. So let's forget about that for a minute and the oh, by the way, because we'll get to that in about 5 minutes. But Joel, let's talk about what that 30 represents.
Well, the 30 is a calibration. It's a measurement of how much work your team was able to get done in a particular period of time. This is good. It was a fixed period of time and a fixed team. And we're able to measure it. So now, if we take a look at the remaining amount in our backlog, we can provide you with a calculated estimate instead of a wild-ass guess on how long things will take. So we might now have 450 points in our backlog, and we can do about 30 story points per sprint. Anyone? Calculator, a lot. What did you say? 15. Did
assuming you do that no bugs. Assuming
assuming no bugs and all that kind of stuff. So you can start now providing you an estimate of duration. If the business goes, that's too long. What's the next discussion?
What
features do you want to cut? Right. Let's talk about value. In fact, that's why we like this. Is because they're not like, I have to cut feature. You know, if you ask them, you know, to prioritize their features, what do we see? All of them are must-haves, right? But now we're saying you have to cut something. Your firstborn child or your secondborn child?
Secondborn, definitely.
Always my first.
I'm telling him
I
that.
Ruined him. I was a bad parent. I learned on him, and I'm better the second time.
That's good. Yeah. At least you're honest about that.
I know. What was I just talking about?
I have no idea.
Right.
Maybe rule number one, when Joel talks, at least someone in the room listens.
cutting features. But actually, it talks about value more than anything else. So now we're going to say, which do you want to cut? We focus on a prioritization, and thus focusing on delivering as much value versus noise in that amount of time.
We have a question from contestant number one, our number one contestant of the day. Oh, she is, I
like a ninja.
I'm, if you ever, listen, if he ever gets ill, he has, are you Canadian?
Yes, I am. See?
Damn it. Oh, perfect. I was going to offer to marry you so you have American citizenship or Hong Kong citizenship. The problem is Joel has issues getting into the United States. It's a long story. It's like every time he comes to a, I tweeted getting ready for the session with Joel. He goes, dude. Like, he sends me a text message like 8 seconds after the Twitter comes up. Dude, I'm at the border. They're going to like Google it and find it and not let me in because they think I'm working.
Because that happened to me.
It did happen.
They Googled me.
So if he can't make it to a conference, you can actually do the conference with me.
Perfect.
Session with me. So you're my backup. So the question was, what was the question again? The question was, how come you're not factoring the growth of the product backlog? Or more appropriately, the amount of bugs the developers will add, the amount of OBTWs the business will add, and because we're reprioritizing, we're reevaluating, and reestimating at the end of every sprint, the business can actually take things out of the backlog. It doesn't happen in the first few sprints, but it actually does happen as the project progresses. That is the next thing we wanted to talk about. I'm gonna pause just for 30 seconds just to review so we're all on the same page. We started with user stories. Okay, we estimated those user stories in the form of story points, which, remember, are not a exact value but a relative scale, right? We had the baseline and the two, or the big jug of beer. We used planning poker to estimate the story points as a way to facilitate the conversation. We put the story, we put the user stories with their story points and the priority into the product backlog. The developers overcommitted, underdelivered on the first sprint like normal. Which is okay, that's perfect, we know it's gonna happen. And now we have our first team velocity number, which is the amount of work the developers can do on the first, or the cumulative average of story points the developers can do on a fixed duration, iteration or a sprint. So now the first sprint is over, and we have 450 items in the backlog. Let's just do simple math. Let's just say we're able to do 25 story, our velocity is 25. That would give us four, what is that, Joel? Yeah, that's four, 18 iterations. And in theory, our first estimate is 18 iterations. If we have 2 week iterations, how long does it take for the project to be over? Right? 2 weeks times 18, 36 weeks. However, contestant number one from Canada, do you like the queen too? Yeah, I agree. Get her off your money. Contestant number one from Canada
put
said,
Kate on the money.
What about the growth of the backlog. So let's actually go into that. That is the very next thing we wanted to talk about. Where is the backlog?
I actually want to bring up one little thing.
God.
What happens when I change the team or the technology?
That's important.
That I've based this calibration on?
Recalibrate.
It's exactly right. In fact, these calibrations kind of go out the window. By the way, this happened to us just recently, where we started, you know, being really good at estimating Silverlight type work, and all of a sudden we're moving to HTML5, and we're like, hey, no problem, we can estimate this. Wrong. Our velocity went down by about 50%.
It was huge.
Based on our, like, we had no idea, right? When we added team members, that would actually decrease our velocity because we'd take time to train them or to orient them or to do whatever. So lots of things impact this, and the key is always recalibrate. Always, always, always. And this is why when we work with organizations, we try to make sure that teams stay together. A lot of people will put a team together for a project, then disseminate the team and put them on another project. Well, how's that going to help you estimate the size of the project? Why don't you keep them together? They're actually pretty good at working together. We can actually, they can estimate. We can figure out what their velocity is kind of like if they're working with similar technology, even if it's a different business problem. So keeping teams together are probably a pretty good thing. Yes, sir.
I just start reading my Twitter feed.
We're going to get to that last.
You can be contestant number two. Are you and her talking together?
Yeah.
So let's actually go through that. So we actually have 15 minutes, which is perfect, because we're done with the slides. We're done with the theory. Now let's get a little bit more nuts and bolts. And we have more than enough time to go through it. And we'll probably stick with this Excel spreadsheet for the next 10 minutes or so. And hopefully can do some questions as well. So this is what I just described, right? We have a fictitious scenario. The size of the backlog was 100 at the beginning of the sprint. Can everyone read this? Right, so I don't have to read the whole thing, right? The team committed to 10, finished 7, which makes our team velocity 7. Okay. We added 5 items to the backlog. Those are the OBTWs. We added 1 bug because our development team rocks, right? They had, they only added 1 bug.
Because we didn't test.
Don't tell them that. We didn't remove anything from the backlog yet. As I said, that usually happens later in the project cycle. And then the next line, number row 9, says sprint estimate to completion. So we say we're about 14.14. So we have, you guys asked actually the same question. She asked, you know, what about the growth of the backlog? You asked about bugs. We're going to address that in just a second. So we're 14.14 sprints to completion. If our sprints are 1 month, we know this is a 14-month project. However, 2 things. 1, cone of uncertainty. We're only at the first sprint. We're probably off by a factor of like 1.25. That has to be accounted for. You don't say that, I mean, you don't do any math to that 14.4. You don't adjust that number. But you say, we estimate today, after sprint 1, that it's going to take about 14 sprints to go. But we know that our estimate is pretty lousy. In 2 or 3 iterations, we're going to be more confident of that 14. So if the marketing team needs to start planning things like X number of weeks out, you say, hold on, if it's possible, wait until the next iteration, or wait maybe 2 iterations when we start getting things like bugs, growth of the backlog. So in this scenario, we grew the backlog by 5 items and we added 1 bug. So we actually grew the backlog by 6 items. So let's actually take a look at what that would happen. Now, Joel, I don't know if I want you to talk about that. I'll talk about that.
Hello.
So here's what happens is you have some bugs and you need to estimate what the bug is going to be. Right? In order to be able to work on it. When does that work get done? Can anyone tell me? Or tell Joel?
When do you estimate the bug, I think is what you're asking.
Or assess the bug.
See, the bug clearly goes through 2 stages, right? It could be assessment and then fix, right? So the reality is I might have a wrong piece of text on a website, and it might be look like a small fix, but then when you get in there, you realize, wow, that data is being auto-generated by the data access layer is all messed up. Ooh, that's going to take a month's worth of work, right? So, but what one of the things that we can't do is estimate how long it's going to take to assess, right? Because sometimes that's unestimatable. I might have no clue how big that bug is until I actually start to try to fix it, right? This is why when we look at bugs, we really try to find the ones that are most severe, right? The ones that are crippling us more often. Because when we invest in observing them, we invest in looking at them, it is actually, when we start doing it, it's a complete unknown. And to this day, I have yet to go to a developer and say, here's a bug, how long is it going to take you to fix? I'll get, you know, a ninja ball thrown at me in the head going, so, you know, go. We have to look at it first.
So what Joel is saying, right, is that we have to assess these bugs and the bugs go through this cycle. We have to allocate a percentage of our time for that. And we also have to allocate a percentage of our time for rework. Because we're going to screw things up. We're going to have to refactor. We're agile, right? We're going to went down a path, and there's going to be things that are that we just didn't account for in the beginning. As Joel said, you know, maybe not as drastic as going from Silverlight to HTML5, but we need some time for rework. So let's just, without answering your question directly, let me then go through this slide. Goodness, you can see I'm slide texture. Let me go through this spreadsheet. Just let me do 1 or 2 iterations, and then we'll come back and address the question. So in the previous example, we completed 7, and we added 6. So that has the growth of the backlog, which means our backlog after sprint 1 was 99. So we actually did good. Usually the backlog goes up after the first sprint. So the team says we can do 8. So they pull 8 out of the backlog, they complete 8. Our cumulative team velocity is now 7.5, right? Because they did 7 in the first one, 8 in the second one. However, the business added 4 OBTWs. The developers added 2 bugs. Nothing was removed. That gives us 12.93 or 13 weeks to completion. However, forgetting the cone of uncertainty for a minute, this estimate needs to be adjusted. And this is we want to make a mathematical adjustment. And Joel's recommendation is that as the project progresses, you factor in a larger amount of time for bug reassessment, backlog growth, and rework, refactoring and rework. However, in the beginning of the project, we're only going to allocate maybe 5% of the time. Right? So we're going to basically discount our team velocity by 5%. So I'm going to times the 7.75 times 0.95. Right? I'm just reducing the team velocity to something like 6.9. And then I just get a new weeks to completion, which is 13.61. Okay? And that number goes up because we are factoring in that number. Now, this should start to become a little clear of what we're doing here, but let's just do one more iteration, because I always like to say that it takes about anywhere between 2 and 5 iterations for you to get a really solid view of your project, both because of the cone of uncertainty, but also because of using this technique. So now we have 97 items in the backlog. If you remember, we had 99. We completed 8, but we added 6. So we're up to 97. Again, we take out 8, we finish 8, our velocity goes up to 7.7. The OBTWs are going down finally. It went to 2. However, the bugs are going up. We added 3. However, the business, now looking at the project, has taken 2 items out of the backlog.
Like, that's a real scenario. Whatever.
About as real of a scenario as the Queen of Alien being hot. So then, if you do this, our raw number of sprints to completion would be 12 iterations, or 12 sprints. We're still going to discount that by a factor of 5%, which brings us to 12.63. And then we do this exercise 1 or 2 more times. We'll do it real fast. You know, we did 9 items. Our velocity is this. Here's what we've added. And now we're increasing that number ever so slightly as the project progresses. So now we're saying we're going to allocate 10% of the time of this project for rework and for bugs, backlog growth, all that type of stuff, because we just don't know. Right? We don't know in sprint 6, 7, 8, and 9 how many bugs we're going to add. But we do know that we're going to increase that number. We're going to eventually, if we did this for 10, 11, 12 sprints, you might see that number go to like 50% of the time of the sprint is actually being allocated for rework, bugs.
And I want to stress that this allocation helps you address bug assessment work, not necessarily bug work, right? Because when you put a bug back on the backlog, you can still schedule it to be part of your sprint.
And it goes into the next sprint and it gets reprioritized, right? But you need to assess that bug.
Question here really quick. No, just X number of story points. So you can have one in there that's 8 story points. We'll just pull one in, right?
Yeah, these numbers, the 85, 92, that's actually the cumulative number of story points.
Yeah.
What we try to recommend is
that all the things in the backlog that are ready to be started are probably close to the same size. We recommend about a half day to a day's worth of work.
So we have a lot of questions.
Yeah, so right here. I told you they'd ask that.
He did say that they would ask that.
Breakfast this morning.
Because I find that sometimes, as they get into it, it's not smaller than they thought because there's a lot more stuff.
Or larger. Yeah. So one of the things that
Repeat the question.
So how do you account for your initial estimate being 3, and then you actually start working on it, and you're like, oh, that's not a 3, that's a 10, right? Ooh, what do we do?
Well, I'll say one thing, and Joel's going to say something different. The agile estimation theory says if you are consistently doing the planning poker and you're doing it over and over again, you might have declared this one a 10 when it's really a 2, and you might have declared this one a 6 when it's really a 3, but then you're going to screw up 2 other ones in the opposite direction and it balances out. Someone laughed, and that's...
I think it's baloney as well.
We think it's pretty much baloney. That's the theory. That's what they teach you. We have to kind of say it because that's part of the theory. But Joel?
So one of the things is we actually track it. So if it's a 3 and it's actually a 6, I want to know about it, because you know why? We didn't have enough discussion, right? So that's just a flag that helps us go into our retrospectives that says, we got pretty good variation here. Why did we have variation? Could we have known something different, right? Was it a technology thing? Did we not know about the technology enough? Should we take another spike to resolve that so that it never comes back? So tracking variance is interesting.
And you have 2 options. You could then go in and start re-estimating the items that you think might be wrong. Or as Joel says, you can track it and then factor that number. The way I discounted the team velocity number, you can then factor that number. You say, well, we're off by 10%, so our now backlog is, add another 8.5 to that, right? So you can actually start factoring that number in as you go forward. Hold on 1 second, Joel.
All right.
We have 5 minutes to go, and we have more questions that we can answer. So why don't we just do our pleasantries, because we're done. So why don't we send everyone off on their way and let people come up and do questions?
Okay.
Right? So, yeah, we're done. Thank you. I just, There are a bunch of people with questions, so just why don't you come up and ask us, and we'll stick around pretty much until...
If you didn't get a chance to talk to us here, we'll probably be in by the Telerik booth most of the
week. Oh, yeah. So I will put up our Twitter accounts. And as Joel said, so I'll put our Twitter accounts up there. That's the easiest way to stop the track us down. And as Joel said, we will be at the Telerik booth tonight at 6 o'clock at the reception party. So pop by, ask us questions there if you want to run out to another session now.
Incorrect.
That's why no one follows you on Twitter. Okay, I'm going to de-mic and goodness, we have lots of questions. Joel has all the wrong answers.
Different developers have different bandwidth.